Hey fam, I'm Dee Dee West, and this is Broken Limelight. We are back for part two of our coverage of O.J. Simpson and the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and Ronald Goldman. Haley couldn't be here with me today. We had a little bit of a scheduling conflict. It's basically the same reason Summer hasn't been here. And Summer will be back. It's just like, all three of us are moms and we're all entrepreneurs. So unfortunately, we have to work around each other a lot and things come up. But Haley will be back for our part three, which newsflash, there's going to be a part three. But in this episode, we're going to go pretty in depth with the entire criminal trial. First of all, I want to say something. I'm going to backtrack on something I said before, just a little bit, not completely. Remember when I said that I felt pretty certain that OJ was guilty? Well, I'm not saying he's not, but since researching, I found a few things that I just can't find answers to, and it's becoming all the more clear to me that I don't think it is possible for him to ever have a fair trial, especially now, unless we get any new evidence. And that'll tie into when we talk about all the conspiracy theories, and like, we'll try to tie together all the evidence and look at every point of view and all the possibilities why he could be the killer, why he could not be the killer. If not him, who else possibly could it have been? Even if it's just to play the devil's advocate, I think it's something that we need to look at. So we left off at part one with the end of the Bronco chase. AC and OJ drove back to OJ's home at Rockingham, where the police were waiting to arrest him. He was handcuffed in the dark so that nobody could witness his perp walk, and then taken back to the police station, where he was finally booked. OJ peacefully surrendered himself to the police and was booked on June 17, 1994. At no point during his arrest, or even before his arrest, did he ask what happened to Nicole. Marcia Clark was a prosecutor, and she was kind of known for being a little bit bitchy, and she also kind of got teased a lot for being unfashionable, which is like stupid and irrelevant, but nonetheless, the media kind of made a spectacle of her appearance. And the entire country was watching and forming these stupid little opinions about Marcia Clark's hair and her outfits and shit like that. Also, the jury straight up just didn't like Marcia. Marcia thought the case would be an easy win, and she had always been pretty successful at talking to women and minorities, so she thought that she could just talk to them and get on their level and they would understand her. That didn't happen. Surveys showed that most of the female juries thought Marcia Clark was a bitch. Marcia often seemed grouchy as shit. Like, she was a workaholic and she also had a lot of things going on in her personal life, like she was going through a divorce and a custody battle. Plus, she was fucking annoyed with this case and the police because everybody was batting their eyes at OJ Simpson after he just murdered two people, in her eyes anyway. She was frustrated because people at work, like police officers and lawyers, continuously called him OJ. As she pointed out, nobody calls Charles Manson Chuck, but people were starry-eyed with OJ, so she actually kept a swear jar, but for OJs instead of swear words. OJ was arraigned on July 2nd, 1994. He pleaded not guilty, and they scheduled the preliminary hearing for June 30th. The defense had to figure out how to deal with the physical evidence against OJ Simpson, which was overwhelming. There was a bloody glove found at the crime scene at Nicole's home at Bundy, and then the other glove, the partner to that glove, was found on OJ's property at Rockingham. These gloves had traces of blood and hair from Nicole and Ron, so whoever wore these gloves had to be the killer. We'll find out later that the DNA evidence points to OJ's DNA being on the gloves as well. The defense realized that they couldn't argue or deny the physical evidence, so instead, they planned to make the evidence seem unreliable. First, they try to convince the jury that the police had planted the evidence in order to frame OJ. Then they would show that investigators mishandled the evidence, and ultimately they were able to straight up confuse the jury who simply didn't have a good understanding of DNA evidence. They were also able to show that members of the LAPD were racist and had in the past spoken planting evidence and framing people and saying hateful things towards black people. The jury ends up having 8 women and 4 men, 8 black, 1 white, 1 Hispanic, and 2 people of mixed race. Jurors were told that they were going to be sequestered and probably kept for 6 months. What this means is that they're going to be, like, taken away from their homes, put in a hotel. They can't talk to anybody about the case. They can't watch any TV or any media. They can't talk about the case with each other.
basically they're coming to work, and then outside of they're doing their duties of the jury, they don't talk about the case. Both the defense and the prosecution need to approve the jury selection, and after they do that and everybody's walking out of the room, OJ took a look at the jury and, you know, got a good look at the diversity and says to his team, "Guys, if this jury convicts me, maybe I did do it." The defense sees the diversity of the jury and runs with the idea of turning the case into an issue of racism. By the way, they allowed cameras into the courtroom for this case, which had never been done before. So
the jury is not allowed to get any outside information about the case. But meanwhile, everybody on the outside of the case has direct eyes into the trial and what's going on in court. The trial begins, and at the very last minute, a new lawyer is added to the prosecution, Chris Darden, who was a black man. The prosecution was all white just a moment ago, so when Darden shows up so suddenly, some of the black jurors were like, well, where the hell did this guy come from? Right away, they started to distrust the prosecution because they now have the impression that they brought in a black guy just because he's black, and they, I don't know, thought maybe that would manipulate the minds of the jurors somehow. The defense has this plan to show the jury that Mark Furman is so racist that he planted evidence and set up O.J. Simpson to take the fall for Nicole's murder. Remember, Mark Furman was the police officer who found the bloody glove at O.J. Simpson's house at Rockingham. So the defense is trying to prove that he didn't just find the glove, he actually planted the glove. Proving that Mark Furman was a racist was really, really easy. He had at one point sued the LA Pension Board asking to be relieved as a police officer to receive pension because his mind was so poisoned by hatred of black people. These were his words. He also did an interview with a writer at some point who had actual audio recordings of him saying the N-word many, many times, as well as discussing police brutality enthusiastically. In the documentary OJ Made in America, Furman describes the night when he was called to the residence after OJ bashed Nicole's car with a bat. Furman describes arriving at the residence and seeing OJ sitting down holding a bat, and Mark tells him to put it down. OJ doesn't listen. He just stares, like, in a blind rage, like he's ready to go into battle. That's how Mark describes it. So Mark tells him a second time, and he still doesn't listen. Finally, Mark pulls out his baton and tells him a third time, put the bat down. Suddenly, OJ's whole demeanor changes, and there was a sudden calm that came over his face. And then he said, "Oh, I'm sorry, officer." Furman says he then asked Nicole if she wanted to make a report, and she said no. Then Furman tells the camera that he recalls feeling displeasure that she was allowing herself to be treated like that. And then he tells Nicole, "It's your life." The defense introduces to the court Mark Furman's file, and they want to present every single time that he used a racial slur. The judge, Judge Ito, has to decide if all of this is going to be admissible. Chris Darden was the one to argue for the prosecution, and he argued that just hearing the N-word was going to blind the jury and make all of this about race instead of focusing on the murder and the evidence. He tried to explain that the word carried too much weight, but then Johnny Cochran got up to refute this, and he's mad. He's saying that Darden's remarks are demeaning to African Americans, saying that they live with offensive words, looks, and treatment every day of their lives, and to say that they can't clearly think in the presence of this word is outrageous, and he's ashamed that Darden would become an apologist for Mark Furman. Ultimately, Judge Ito allows it. F. Lee Bailey would cross-examine Furman and ask him if he's ever used the N-word at any time in the previous 10 years. And by the way, while he's questioning him, he's not saying the N-word like I am. They're saying the actual word. Bailey says it multiple times, and it really does kind of sting when you hear it today. Anyway, Furman says, "Nope, I have not used that word in the past 10 years. Again, there are recordings of him saying it, so we know now that he lied on the stand. Marcia Clark had a real problem here because Mark Furman was the officer who found the bloody glove at OJ's home at Rockingham. So this was like the biggest piece of evidence, and she kind of has to bring him on the stand, even though everybody knows that they can't believe a single fucking word that he says. Because if she doesn't bring Mark Furman on the stand and he was the one that found the glove, then it kind of looks like she's admitting that he did plant the evidence. In February 1995, the jury was shown the contents of Nicole's secret safety deposit box. Inside the safety deposit box were diaries and photos documenting the abuse, as well as a will that Nicole had prepared dated September 30th, 1990.
There were also news articles and letters that OJ had written her that said things like, "How did I get so crazy?" and "Let me start by expressing to you how wrong I was for hurting you. There is no acceptable excuse for what I did." Darden said, "It appears to us what Nicole Brown was doing was leaving a trail for us of what happened in 1989. These letters were shown in the courtroom on a big screen, but the judge didn't allow the news articles to be entered as evidence, and the jurors were not shown the photos right away. The defense then questioned Ron Shipp, who was a friend of O.J. Simpson's and Nicole's, and a former police officer who had given, he gave, like, trainings for domestic abuse situations. Nicole had confided in him about the abuse, and O.J. had tried to hire him for his legal team, but he refused because he says that he knows O.J. did it. Ron said on the stand that the day after the murders, O.J. confided in him that he had had dreams about killing Nicole. The defense tried to paint Ron Shipp as a starstruck wannabe friend to O.J. who secretly had feelings for Nicole, but Ron stood by his account. Ron also said that he saw O.J. throughout the week after the murders, and he didn't seem sad or seem to show any sense of loss or grief over Nicole. He did say that O.J. seemed angry as he watched the news and saw reports about himself being accused of murdering them, but never sad. During a break in questioning, Ron Shipp turned to O.J. and mouthed to him across the room, "Tell the truth, O.J." O.J. appeared not to notice, and Judge Ito sternly told the jurors to disregard that remark. On February 12, 1995, the jurors took a field trip to the crime scene at Bungie and also to O.J.'s home at Rockingham. Apparently, these kinds of field trips are unusual but not completely unprecedented, but in this case, it would cost thousands of dollars in police overtime, and it literally halted traffic. The residents of Brentwood were basically forced to quarantine because all the traffic was making it impossible to leave their homes. The reason they also went to OJ's house and not just Nicole's was because they wanted the jury to consider whether OJ could actually have time to get home from McDonald's, go kill two people, and get back home in time for his flight. OJ's home at Rockingham was only about a 5-minute drive from Nicole's home on Bundy. The jurors were able to see the area where Nicole and Ron were killed, though the blood had been cleaned up and it was now just covered in police tape. They had traced outlines of the shoe prints for them to observe. Heading inside in groups of four, they then viewed the rooms where Nicole Simpson had drawn herself a candlelit bath, left a cup of half-eaten ice cream, and then put her children to bed before she was killed. Everything was labeled by signs so nobody would have to say a word to the jurors, and they were not allowed to talk to each other either. There were requests made to hide things like trophies and statues of OJ, and a complaint was made that they should take down the photos of OJ with his kids and his new girlfriend Paula, saying that it wouldn't be fair for the jury to see that, but Judge Ito ultimately ignored the complaint. There were hundreds of police officers from the LAPD on duty, along with the bomb-sniffing Black Labrador. 20 policemen on motorcycles escorted the unmarked car carrying OJ while 4 police helicopters hovered overhead. On March 29th, OJ's limo driver from the night of the murders was questioned. His name was Alan Park. Remember how OJ's flight was at 11:45 p.m., but he didn't actually leave his house until 11:15? Well, the driver, Alan Park, actually arrived at OJ's house at 10:22 p.m. and waited there for nearly an hour. He drove around the front of the house while he was looking for the house number, and he did not see OJ's white Bronco, nor did he see it 17 minutes later when he tried driving around the house to find another entrance. He tried ringing the intercom a few times, but nobody answered, so he went back to his car. At about 11 p.m., he saw a dark figure walk into the driveway, which he described as someone about 6 feet tall and weighing 200 pounds, and they appeared to be black. He says, "That's when I got back up and out of the car and rang the intercom. This time there was an answer, which was Mr. Simpson. He told me that he overslept and he just got out of the shower and he would be down in a minute." OJ's neighbor testified that he did not see the white Bronco when he walked his dog around the Simpson estate between 9:30 and 9:45 on the evening of June 12th. He further testified that on June 13th at around 7 a.m., he noticed the Bronco parked on Rockingham at a weird angle. Alan Park also saw OJ carrying a knapsack out of his house, but after they got to the airport, he unloaded his stuff and he didn't have the knapsack anymore. It's theorized that the knapsack may have contained the murder weapon and his bloody clothes, and that he may have stashed the knapsack into a bigger bag before his flight. The prosecution called a witness who saw OJ at the airport standing next to a trash can, reached down into his bag and grabbing something before throwing it away and then closing his bag again. Now let's talk about the physical evidence for a sec. The evidence is a bloody pair of gloves. One glove was found at the crime scene, which was Nicole's house, and the other was found on the Rockingham property by Mark Furman. The gloves each had blood from Nicole and Ron, indicating that whoever they belonged to or whoever was wearing them was the killer.
There is also blood on the gloves that is consistent with OJ's. There were trails of blood leading from the crime scene down the alley and into OJ's Bronco. The defense had a guy on their team named Barry Sheck who was super experienced in working with DNA, which was pretty rare at this time. By 1994, DNA analysis was still pretty new, and the common person didn't really know anything about it. Shows like CSI didn't start coming out until like 2000, so even when clear evidence was presented, a lot of people didn't really understand it. It was kind of junk science at this point. Barry Sheck knew how to poke holes in the evidence and made it go from something concrete to something vague. On April 11, 1995, the defense brought in LAPD criminologist Dennis Fung to the stand. They questioned him about how evidence is collected and what measures are taken to make sure it isn't tampered with. Sheck was so detailed in his questioning that everybody was getting kind of annoyed. He questioned Fung for 9 days about every little detail of how he did his job. He was on the stand longer than any other witness. Unfortunately for Fung, he did a number of things that would end up looking pretty questionable. For one, he admitted that when collecting blood from the crime scene, he had missed a couple of drops, but then he went back later to get them. He also admitted that he did not wear rubber gloves while collecting the evidence, and also that he had to shoo the dog away from the DNA, so it's possible that little Kato the Akita contaminated the evidence as well. Fung had said in the past that he personally was the one who collected the leather gloves, and it was later discovered that he was actually supervising a trainee named Andrea Mazzola, and she was the one who actually collected the gloves and placed them into a bag. Sheck said to him, "You did not tell the grand jury that Andrea Mazzola was the one who picked up the hat and picked up the glove? You did not tell the grand jury about the existence of Andrea Mazzola at all? And the testimony you gave the grand jury was under oath?" Fung conceded to all three questions, but would later say, "It wasn't a conscious decision. It's just the way I answered the questions." Andrea Mazzola admitted to a few mistakes at the crime scene while collecting evidence, including using one swatch to collect blood from three separate spots in the Ford Bronco, and occasionally not changing gloves when picking up different pieces of evidence. Then there was a vial of blood that they took from OJ at the police station, and an officer named Van Adder put it in his pocket and drove 20 miles and hand-delivered it to Fung, which is weird, and it shows that there was a big opportunity for police to frame OJ Simpson. Van Adder would also be accused of planting the bloody sock in OJ's bedroom. Fung acknowledged that there was bloody evidence that was placed in a plastic containers and left in a vehicle from 11:30 a.m. to about 6:30 p.m. So that's about 7 hours, and this was in June in California, so it must have been a hot day. Also, at the crime scene, the police took a blue blanket from inside of Nicole's house, and they used it to cover her body. Of course, that blanket could have had OJ's DNA on it, which would now contaminate the crime scene. It was also discovered that Ron Goldman's bloody shirt was placed in a bag while still wet and had developed an odor, so it was definitely not stored properly. The bloody sock from OJ's bedroom had a preservative in it, and the defense tried to say that it had too much of the preservative. I mean, this is a disaster. Like, the prosecution is like, there is a trail of blood from their bodies to his car and into his bedroom. But the police fucked up so bad with handling the evidence that the defense could imply that whoever the real killer is, their DNA has been wiped clean by the police. Not only are they saying that the police framed OJ, but that their negligence is letting some other killer get away. Fung was asked why they didn't put police tape around the Ford Bronco, and he said, "It wasn't necessary. There was nobody around." Later, people would be seen touching the Bronco and photographing it. After 9 days, Fung finally leaves the stand, and as he's exiting the courtroom, he stops and shakes hands with OJ and his lawyers. At this point, the jury is also exiting the courtroom, and it's unclear how many of them saw that. Earlier in that day, Bob Shapiro had handed out some fortune cookies and said, "These are from Hang Fung Restaurant." It was supposed to be a joke, I guess. He would later apologize to Fung about that, and I guess it's possible that Fung shaking hands with OJ's team was just a way to say no hard feelings after that fortune cookie thing. Still, it's really hard to know what that was about, and it just fucking looked weird. By April 1995, the jurors were growing impatient and claustrophobic. A few of them were recused by this point, like Jeanette Harris, who lied about whether she had been involved in a domestic violence situation. So they were replaced by alternates, but the jury remained mostly people of color. There would be racial tensions among them. Harris said that she was kicked by a white juror and that the deputies treated the white jurors better than everyone else. She said that the jury was divided by race and also said that the jurors were going against Ito's instructions by talking to their families and to each other about the case. Again, they're not allowed to talk to anybody and they can't watch TV or have any kind of media that might influence their opinion in the case. The deputies were searching their rooms all the time and they felt violated. Ito had three sheriffs reassigned and the jury was getting fed up. They refused to go to court one day until Judge Ito made them, and when they finally appeared, many of them were wearing all black, kind of like a funeral. Like, this was supposed to be a protest. At this point, the case is already at risk of a mistrial because the defense and the prosecution are constantly shooting down everything the other one says and making objections to argue, like, legal definitions and shit, and then, like, the jury members are getting replaced left and right and they're running out of alternates. It's clear that Judge Ito has completely lost control of his courtroom, so he was like, okay, let's take a break for a couple days so he could talk to the jurors individually. After a four-day hiatus, they resumed with the testimonies. On May 1st, a black juror pleaded with Judge Ito that she couldn't take it anymore, and he found good cause to excuse her from the jury. She was replaced by a Hispanic woman. There are only five alternates left at this point. The jury now has seven blacks, three whites, and two Hispanics. There are nine women and three men. On May 2nd, a forensic chemist testified that a sample from a bloody trail near the spot where Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were killed was found to be consistent with OJ's blood type. Blood and enzyme tests revealed that blood found alongside the trail of bloody shoe prints leading from the murder scene was the same type as OJ's blood. Only 0.5% of the population, or 1 in 200 people, have that blood type. There were tests done on the bloody glove that was found at the crime scene as well as on the back gate, and they showed that that blood was consistent with Ron's blood type, and of course there was blood on the front gate that was consistent with Nicole's blood type. Ron Goldman's family filed a lawsuit against OJ for wrongful death, seeking monetary damages, and accused him of outrageous savagery. On May 8th, a molecular biologist and DNA expert took the stand and explained how the testing used was the most accurate in existence at that time. She also explained that if evidence had degraded because of being improperly stored, it wouldn't just turn it into OJ's DNA. They also testified that the blood that was found on the bottom of Ron Goldman's shoe was consistent with Nicole's blood type. Then they said that judging from one of OJ's blood samples taken from Nicole's driveway, had an extremely rare bonding pattern. Supposedly, the odds that the blood could come from anybody other than OJ Simpson were about 1 in 170 million. They did admit that putting the evidence in plastic bags and then, like, inside of a truck without air conditioning on a hot day would not be their first choice of procedure, but they also suggested that the real harm would only be caused if the evidence was treated this way for an extended period of time. For days and days, Barry Scheck would question all of these scientists and the DNA experts, and throughout, he tried to prove that DNA testing can be imprecise and that the results are open to interpretation. On May 19th, what would have been Nicole's 36th birthday, the prosecution described in gruesome detail their version of how she was killed. They believe that Nicole opened the door expecting Ron, but instead encountered OJ, who immediately subdued her. Then, Ron happened to walk up and see what OJ was doing to Nicole, and as he started to run towards her, OJ grabbed him from behind with his left hand and likely put the knife at Ron's throat with his right hand. Ron may have tried to reach for OJ's left hand to try and free himself and rip the glove off of OJ's hand where it fell into some foliage. Assistant District Attorney Brian Kelberg insisted that it was necessary for the jury to see the photos of the injuries so that they can see that it was done by someone in rage, like an abusive ex-husband. Barry Scheck questioned a criminologist named Colin Yamaguchi, who admitted that he got a small stain of blood on his glove after having held a vial with OJ Simpson's blood in it. This presented a problem because Yamaguchi failed to record the exact times that he handled each piece of evidence. He also handled OJ's glove, but we have no idea if he handled the glove and then the vial, or if he handled the vial first and then transferred the blood onto OJ's glove. More jurors were recused, mainly because they were talking about the case to each other or discussing, like, book deals. With only two alternates left and months to go, everybody's kind of nervous that this could end in a mistrial. On June 6th, the jury and two remaining alternates heard from a medical examiner who also offered a detailed description of how Nicole and Ron died. He graphically described this photograph that showed Nicole's face and below it her neck wound, which was completely gaping and exposing. Like, the wound actually exposed part of her spinal cord. The medical examiner said that the photos helped to prove the theory that Nicole was probably knocked unconscious in a struggle before her assailant turned to Ron and killed him. Then the assailant returned to Nicole, who was laying face down on, and this is based on the autopsies. He concluded that Nicole tried to fight back based on the cuts and bruises on her hands. The blow to the head that she received not only knocked her out, but it bruised her brain. When her neck was slit, he said that she was probably face down because she didn't swallow any blood through her air pipe. The fatal wound was probably inflicted by a right-handed person using a single-edged knife. Judge Ito repeatedly told the jury that they were allowed to take a break or excuse themselves if they were uncomfortable looking at any of the crime scene photos. None of them did. On June 8th, the court day ended abruptly when one of the jury members who sits in the front row of the jury box left the courtroom during the testimony of the medical examiner. She had been seated immediately in front of the autopsy photos that showed Ron Goldman's brutally slashed body. The medical examiner also testified that the killer may have held a knife to Goldman's throat, slicing superficial parallel wounds while threatening him. He further testified that it could have taken a man of O.J. Simpson's strength and size less than a minute to inflict the wounds on Ron. He believed the killer was holding Ron Goldman from behind and sliced the knife lightly across his throat before inflicting a final gash that severed his jugular vein and damaged his aorta. Because this little area in front of Nicole's house was gated, he believed that the killer could have trapped Ron and killed him in less than a minute. He said, "If Mr. Goldman was confronted by the assailant in this confined area, he has no place to escape, especially if he's cornered between that railing and that tree and that sapling. He's stuck there." As he's explaining this, he's using Brian Kelberg, one of the prosecutors, like, as an example. Like, in the courtroom, as he's explaining how Nicole was killed, he actually grabs Kelberg's hair and pulls it back and acts like he's slashing his throat. Like, this whole thing was, it was so extra. Like, this is such a drama. And then when he explains Ron's murder, he went up behind Kelberg and grabbed him while using a ruler, like, pretending it's a knife and slashing his throat. Like, they're doing this in the courtroom, and he's like, and then he grabbed her like this. Like, this must have been such a fucking spectacle. The coroner described more of Ron Goldman's injuries. He had abrasions on top of bruises on his hands that appear to be caused by his hands flailing about and maybe hitting tree branches and the gate. The defense tried to claim that Ron had punched OJ, but the injuries on his hands were not those of a closed fist having hit someone, and OJ had no bruises on him immediately following the murders. This is what the coroner's saying. On the anniversary of the murders, Nicole Brown's father filed a wrongful death suit just one day before the statute of limitations would run out, charging that OJ planned and prepared to assault, batter, and murder Nicole Brown Simpson. On the seventh day of the medical examiner's examination, he described three of the fatal stab wounds to Ron Goldman. There were two gashes to his chest that cracked through a rib and punctured his right lung, and a third that hit the aorta, the major artery leading from the heart. There was also a fatal cut across Ron's neck. The medical examiner told jurors that after slashing his throat, the killer may have poked him in the face at least four or five times with a knife, just to see if he was actually dead. He said, "They are all superficial punctures, and I have no way of knowing exactly why they were done. It could have been inflicted to check whether he was still alive or not. That would be one conclusion I would draw also." OJ does not have an alibi for this time. He says he was either at home sleeping or chipping golf balls. On June 13th, the testimony was focused on OJ's demeanor on his flight to Chicago on the evening of the murders and the following day when he was told about it. A succession of witnesses testified that OJ was cordial and relaxed on the flight from LA to Chicago
and he did not have a cut on his left hand.
I don't know. That seems like way too specific. Like if somebody were to ask me if somebody on a plane had a cut on their hand, I probably wouldn't have checked.
On the flight home from Chicago, witnesses who either took Simpson to the airport or accompanied him back to Los Angeles described him as frantic, looking skyward, sighing and moaning frequently. His left finger was either wrapped in a bloody Band-Aid or wrapped in a paper towel, based on what the witnesses had said. A Beverly Hills private intern examined OJ on June 15, 1994, 3 days after the murders, and then again 2 days later. He said that OJ was suffering from osteo and rheumatoid arthritis, which most likely prevented him from running or doing any other aerobic activity. He also testified that he carefully looked for cuts, scratches, and bruises on OJ's body that may have indicated that he had a struggle with someone, but he said he found no evidence of such wounds. He noted that OJ had constant pain from surgery on his left wrist following a football injury from 1965. OJ also developed large knuckles that was typical of osteoarthritis, and he suffered from osteoarthritis in his left knee. But, in a blow to the defense, this private intern also conceded under cross-examination that despite OJ's arthritic condition, he was still strong enough to kill two people in the manner that was being suggested by the prosecution. So despite all of these illnesses, he was like, yeah, he still could have done it. At the end of the day, jurors were shown portions of an exercise video featuring OJ Simpson performing various exercises. This video was taped from May 24th to May 27th, 1994, just 2.5 weeks before the murders. On July 18th, jurors were shown another commercial exercise video that was also made just a few weeks before Nicole's murder. During the video workout filmed May 26, 1994, OJ can be seen shadow boxing, throwing jabs and uppercuts, and he says, "Get your space in if you're exercising with your wife, if you know what I mean." And then he smiled and said, "You can always blame it on working out." Another video was presented of a promotional speech that OJ gave in March of 1994. In the video, OJ talks about a vitamin supplement called Juice Plus, saying that the product had so relieved his arthritis symptoms that he had quit taking conventional medication and pain relievers. In August, the focus shifts back to Mark Furman. During cross-examination, Furman had denied using the N-word in the previous 10 years, but the defense located a recorded interview Furman did with a writer where he talks about framing people, setting people up, and filing false reports. And he also says the N-word, like, I think it's like 42 times. The defense planned to show that, one, he's a racist and a corrupt cop, and two, he lied on the stand when he said he didn't use the N-word, effectively perjuring himself. So now, no matter what he says, we can't fucking believe him, which is tough, because he's the one that found the evidence. Now, here's the kicker that nobody could have fucking seen coming. As the defense and the prosecution are all listening to the tapes, they come across something alarming. In these interviews, Furman complained about a high-ranking female police officer named Peggy York, who was his supervising commander. And he talks a lot of shit about this Peggy York. So let me read. This is something from Marsha Clark's book. It's called Without a Doubt. It says, Mark had described two run-ins with York, including one during which she upbraided the squad for writing KKK on the calendar entry for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Mark had snickered, and when she called him on it in private, he claimed, he belittled her to her face. In another dust-up, he refused an assignment from her, supposedly saying, I don't talk to anybody that isn't a policeman, and you're as far from a policeman as I've seen. And as far as that goes, you're about as far from a woman as I've seen. He also said that she, quote, sucked and fucked her way to the top. About women in general, he said, I won't eat with them. I won't have coffee with them. I won't be seen with them. It's embarrassing. Where does some woman 5 feet tall and 98 pounds get off coming out? I can bench press almost 4 times what she weighs. I think he's talking about police women coming out to job assignments. So here's the kicker. Peggy York is the wife of Judge Lance Ito. This is a huge conflict of interest because they're trying to decide if he should allow these tapes to be heard in the court. If Ito allows the tapes to be heard in court,
he could be perceived as doing so to punish Furman. But now, if he doesn't allow the tapes to be played in court, it could be seen as though he's trying to avoid the embarrassment of issues regarding his wife coming before the jury. Or like he's trying to protect the police force because his wife is on it, and he doesn't want to, like, make an embarrassment out of them right now. So Judge Ito was like, I need to take a step back. He admitted that he cannot make the decision about whether or not it's fair for him to preside over this case. So they have another judge make the call, and ultimately it's decided that Ito can continue to preside over the case. But the tapes would not be admissible except for 2 hours out of the 13 hours of recording. And by the way, if you're interested in seeing Judge Ito's ruling, I have uploaded a link to the Broken Limelight website. So they moved on and they continued with trying to prove that Mark Furman is a liar, as he absolutely has said the N-word in the past 10 years. In fact, he said it over 40 times in the recording, and he also recounted numerous episodes of police harassing black suspects, contriving evidence against them, and acknowledging that he participated in such activities himself. Here are some of the things he said. Do you people, don't you shoot to wound them? No, we shoot to kill them. Now the department says we shoot to stop, not kill, which is horseshit. The only way we can stop somebody is to kill the son of a bitch. And what's the big deal? If you've got reason to shoot somebody, you've got reason to kill them. No, if I would have arrested the son of a bitch, I would have killed him. If I ever see the son of a bitch and we're alone, I would kill him. If there's anybody except him and me, dead men tell no tales. See, he killed two policemen. I have an obligation. If I ever have the opportunity, I should kill him. And that's all there is to it. I didn't arrest him under anything. Just took him to the station, ran him for prints, gave him to the detective to compare with what they've got in the area. I'll probably arrest a criminal that way. I'd be able to correlate exactly what I said into a reasonable probable cause for arrest. Even though there's no evidence that Furman planted OJ's bloody glove at the crime scene, the fact that he's admittedly planted evidence in the past means that the defense could move to have all the evidence found by Furman to be thrown out. By now, Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown's families are pissed because the entire focus has shifted to whether or not Mark Furman is a racist. And this is not a trial against Mark Furman, this is about the murders of Nicole and Ron. During an emotional press conference, Fred Goldman said that the tapes had no business at the trial, which is supposed to determine whether O.J. Simpson killed his son and Nicole Brown Simpson. He said, "There was no reason to have 2 hours of this hate to be spewed out over the public airwaves. My son, Nicole, and her family have a right to a fair trial, and this is not fair." Marcia Clark said, "This is a murder case where none of this is relevant. The admission of this evidence, meaning the tapes, is telling the jury, disregard the case, look somewhere else." And even if the bloody glove gets thrown out, there's still so much DNA evidence at the crime scene, in the Bronco and leading up to OJ's house. Marcia goes on to say that if Mark Furman had the opportunity to plant anything, he would have been foolish to try, not knowing whether or not there were eyewitnesses to come to the crime, or whether Simpson had an alibi. How could Furman possibly know for sure that O.J. Simpson would not have an alibi? I mean, he's super fucking famous. He easily could have been at a club, or at a party, or at an awards show or something. Like, how could you possibly know that somebody isn't doing shit? Like, how could you know he would just be sitting at home, sleeping, or chipping golf balls? But the defense continued with their plan, and they started bringing in witnesses to testify to Furman's racism. There was a woman named Kathleen Bell who had met Mark at a Marine recruiting center. At one point, Mark told Bell that when he sees a black man driving with a white woman, he pulls over the car. Bell asked him if he needed a reason. According to her, he said he'd find something. I asked, "What if they're in love?" He said, "That's disgusting." In the same conversation, she testified that Furman said, "If I had my way, I'd gather all the," he says a racial slur, "together and burn them." Bell said that she called the LAPD to report Furman, but she could only recall his first name. She said she didn't ask for his last name before because she was afraid of him. A second witness named Natalie Singer testified that Mark Furman's partner dated her roommate in 1987 and that both officers were frequently guests in her home. She quoted Furman as saying, "The only good N-word is a dead N-word." On a later date, she kicked Furman out of the house for calling her a fucking bitch. She next saw him several years later testifying against O.J. Simpson, prompting her to call the defense. On September 6th, Mark Furman was brought back to the witness stand. He was asked, "Was the testimony that you gave in this case completely truthful?" He replied, "I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege." When somebody pleads the Fifth, basically what that means is I have a right not to incriminate myself and you can't force me to say something incriminating. So they're asking him, "Was the last testimony that you gave in this case completely truthful?" And he replies, "I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege." Then he's asked, "Have you ever falsified a police report?" He replies, "I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege." Then he's asked, "Is it your intention to assert your Fifth Amendment privilege with respect to each question I ask you?" He looks at his lawyer for a second, kind of like for approval. And then he answers, "Yes." And then he's asked, "I only have one other question. Detective Furman, did you plant or manufacture any evidence in this case?" And he replies, "I wish to assert my Fifth Amendment privilege." So this looks shady as fuck. On September 11th, the prosecution began presenting its rebuttal case, even though the defense had not finished its case. The first rebuttal witness was a photographer who took a picture of O.J. Simpson in 1990 during a Chicago Bears football game. And Simpson was, like, broadcasting the game. In that photograph, Simpson is wearing dark gloves that the state contends are the same gloves as the ones found at the murder scene and at Simpson's home after the murders. The defense requested that the jury be instructed to forget the glove had ever been found, which Ito denied. On the 13th, the prosecutors failed to show up for an early hearing, and the judge fined them $250. Marsha Clark complained because the defense attorneys had shown up late to other hearings without any fine. Judge Ito increased their fine to $1,000. Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti berated Judge Ito at a press conference, calling his conduct outrageous, petty, and uncalled for. Garcetti said his office would not pay the fine and sent another lawyer to court to appeal it. Judge Ito backed down and reinstated the original $250 penalty. On September 21st, the jury is informed that they can consider first-degree or second-degree charges. The difference is really whether or not the murders were premeditated. Ron Goldman's murder was almost certainly not premeditated because OJ would have had no way of knowing if he was going to be at Nicole's house. Like, the theory is that OJ, or whoever the killer was, got to Nicole's house and Ron happened to be there. Nobody planned to kill Ron Goldman. But Nicole's murder may well have been premeditated, so OJ could either be charged for first degree and second degree and automatically face a life sentence without parole, or if he's convicted of two second degree murders, the sentence includes the possibility of parole. OJ tells the court, outside the presence of the jury, "I did not, could not, and would not have committed this crime." Despite objections from Marsha Clark, Ito asked OJ to make a routine waiver of his right to testify. Marsha wanted OJ to put the waiver in writing to stop him from making an emotional plea that might have been leaked to jurors through conjugal visits or phone calls or something like that. OJ said in open court, "Much as I would like to address some of the misrepresentations made about myself and Nicole concerning our life together, I am mindful of the mood and the stamina of this jury. I have confidence, a lot more it seems than Miss Clark has, of their integrity, and that they will find as the record stands now that I did not, could not, and would not have committed this crime. I have four kids, two kids I haven't seen in a year. They ask me every week, 'Dad, how much longer? I want this trial over.'" Ron's father, Fred Goldman, said, "It's disgusting what he did. It's disgusting that his dream team, scheme team maybe is more accurate, would come here and stand in front of you and tell you it was his right to make a statement to the court. It is disgusting to me that the judge tolerated it." On September 26th, Marsha Clark began her closing arguments with a preemptive strike against Mark Furman before taking aim at OJ. She said, "It would be a tragedy if, with such overwhelming evidence, you find the defendant not guilty because of the racist attitudes of one officer." She took the jurors through the evening of the murder, showing OJ was unaccounted for between 9:36 p.m. and 10:54, and that he left a trail of evidence from the murder scene to his home. Darden, who argued for a little bit more than an hour, focused on OJ's history of abusing his wife to prove that he had motive to kill her. Darden also brought up Furman telling the jury not to lose focus of the murders of Nicole and Ron Goldman. In closing arguments, Johnny Cochran reiterated to the jury that if the glove does not fit, you must acquit.
If it doesn't fit, you must acquit.
Darden repeatedly described OJ as a time bomb with a burning fuse, growing increasingly closer to a full explosion. Cochran tried to reduce the impact of the accounts of OJ's domestic violence by describing him as imperfect, saying he's not proud of some of the things he did, but these things don't add up to murder. Darden suggested that only OJ could have had motive to kill Nicole and Ron. Cochran suggested that professional killers could have been after Ron Goldman on the night of the killings. Cochran asked the jury why, if OJ was rushing back from a bloody crime scene, was there no blood found on the doorknobs, on the banister, or on the white carpets at OJ Simpson's Rockingham estate? An interesting point. Barry Sheck gets up and explains to the jury that the DNA evidence is unreliable. He says that since the evidence was handled and stored improperly, there are enough questions surrounding the evidence for reasonable doubt. Marcia Clark didn't see it that way. She says, "I don't have to say anything else. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the people of the state of California, because we have proven beyond a reasonable doubt, far beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defendant committed these murders, we ask you to find the defendant guilty of murder in the first degree of Ronald Goldman and Nicole Brown." Darden ridiculed OJ's alibi. He said, mockingly, "Chipping golf balls? There were golf balls in that little black bag?" He said, "That was the night he was supposedly suffering from acute arthritis. They want you to throw your common sense out the window. Just chuck it out the window. You can't do that. They have one racist cop." On October 2nd, the jury shocked everyone when they reached a verdict after deliberating for less than 4 hours. Legal analysts predicted that it would take anywhere between 2 days and 2 months. Earlier in the day, they had requested to hear again the testimony of Alan Park, the limo driver. It seems that what they were looking at was whether or not OJ actually had time to go commit the murders and then run back home in the short time for which he had no alibi. OJ's home was only about a 5-minute drive from Nicole's. Park said that he arrived at OJ Simpson's house at 10:22 p.m. the night of the murders, and he didn't see OJ's Bronco parked outside when he was searching the curb for the street numbers. He testified that at 10:55 p.m., he saw a large shadowy figure of a black person at the front door of Simpson's Rockingham estate. By now, Park had been sounding the intercom for about 15 minutes. Moments later, Simpson answered the intercom and said that he had overslept. The verdict is announced. Not guilty. You could hear Ron Goldman's family sobbing in the background as the verdict was read. And Marcia Clark and Chris Darden looked like they're going to cry too. I'm going to upload a clip of this to BrokenLimelight.com too. OJ Simpson was now a free man. He went back to his home at Rockingham where his family and friends were preparing a party for him. The LAPD had to send police units to his home for crowd control. This must have been infuriating because OJ used to be friends with the police and his legal team just spent the last nearly a year making complete fools out of their department. They mocked and humiliated them, and they told the entire world that the LAPD was incompetent. And not just incompetent, they were trash. So now OJ's free, and the police have to go to his house to keep him safe while he celebrates. Detective Paul Bishop said, "Way back in the beginning, I said to Detective Ron Phillips, 'Are we going to win this case?' And Ron said, 'If we can't convict this guy, we may as well turn our badges in and go home.' After the verdict, I walked up to Ron and said, 'You're right. We may as well turn in our badges.' The next 2 days, you couldn't get through on the phone lines to personnel because there were so many police and detectives trying to get their paperwork and retire. The ripple effect is going to be unbelievable." All of OJ's friends were at the party, like Al Cowlings and Rob Kardashian. It wasn't long before everybody realized that the rest of the world was not celebrating with them. Polls showed that more than half of the country was outraged by the verdict. OJ's personal agent dropped him as a client and his pay-per-view deal collapsed. The country clubs don't want him back. Everybody thinks he's a murderer. He put up signs on Sunset Boulevard at the entrance of Brentwood that said, "Welcome to Brentwood, home of the Brentwood Butcher," and also, "Murderer loose in Brentwood." When the district attorney announced that they were closing the case and no longer looking for the, quote, real killers of Ron and Nicole, OJ was livid. OJ had his son Jason read a statement from him saying that he would make it a priority in his life to find a real killer or killers. Jason looked really awkward, kind of hiding his face like he was embarrassed to be reading those words out loud. I don't think they ever did anything to look for the, quote, real killers. I did see some interviews later where they asked Jason, like, "Hey, so you said your dad was going to look for the killers. What has he done that you know of?" And Jason's like, OJ wasn't all in the clear yet.
he still had to face the wrongful death suits filed against him by the families of Ron and Nicole. In February of 1997, the jury for the civil case found OJ liable and made him pay $33.5 billion in punitive damages. And they took no time to deliberate. But let me explain to you the difference between the criminal trial and the civil trial. So, in criminal law, the parties are the defendant, the person who is being accused of committing the crime, and the state or federal government. So, in this case, the criminal trial against OJ Simpson, it's like the government, the state of California against OJ Simpson. So, the government is involved because they have broken a law like murder or theft. It's a law established by the government. So, in civil law, it's more private. It's like disputes between individuals and entities, things like defamation, divorce, negligence. This is a big difference because in the criminal trial, it's like the government is trying to convince O.J. Simpson. And in the civil trial, it's Ron Goldman's parents and Nicole Brown's parents that are suing O.J. Number two is the sanctions or the punishments. This is also different because in criminal cases, when the government is suing you, the punishment can be things like community service or the death penalty. Whereas in a civil trial, the punishment is more often like paying monetary damages or a restraining order. This is why, like, Goldman can't sue O.J. Simpson and seek a punishment of death. He can't do that. Only the government can do that. So this is why when O.J. was found liable, he had to pay the Goldman's money. Finally, and most importantly, is the way that they look at evidence. Now, in criminal cases, there is the burden of proof, meaning the defendant must be proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt in order to charge him. That means you have to prove it. The prosecution has to prove it. So in OJ's criminal trial, the jury didn't believe that OJ was proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt because they had a lot of doubts surrounding the evidence and the reliability of LAPD. So, in their minds, the prosecution couldn't prove that OJ did it, at least not without a doubt. In a civil trial, they don't have the burden of proof. They have a preponderance of evidence, meaning they just have to lean towards him being guilty more than not guilty. And I literally mean lean. Like, they can't be 50-50, but they can be 49-51. And if their 51 is like, I'm leaning towards he looks guilty, then that's a guilty charge. So that's a huge difference. In the civil trial, there was more than enough evidence for them to consider him liable. And that's probably why it took them no time to deliberate. So in the civil trial, the only punishment possible for OJ was monetary compensation. He was ordered $33.5 million made up of $8.5 million in compensatory damages to the Goldmans and $25 million in punitive damages to be split between the Goldmans and Nicole's children. Kim Goldman said, "The dollar amount meant nothing to us. We were just thrilled that 12 people unanimously determined that he was the killer of Ron and Nicole. The rest was just paper." Now, OJ didn't have all the money he was being ordered to pay, and the Goldmans never actually got that money. OJ was supposed to pay them, so the Goldmans started seeking all of OJ's assets that they could find, and he was forced to hand over all of his shit, like his golf clubs and his Andy Warhol silkscreen of himself. So the city of Los Angeles pulls up to his house, essentially to repossess all of his items, but his friends and his family show up first to clear the place out and make it look like he's living in an empty house and has nothing of value. Some of his really valuable sports memorabilia was put into a storage locker in Northern California. OJ's agent Mike, he was the one who told OJ to not take his arthritis medication so his hand would swell. He was seen hauling off tons of memorabilia, including OJ's Heisman Trophy. Mike says that he had an arrangement with OJ where, like, he would provide services and then OJ would pay him money for those services. And now that OJ can't, Mike's like, I'm just going to take some of this for myself. So he's actually, like, stealing OJ's memorabilia with the intention of selling it to make his money back. OJ ended up moving out of his home at Rockingham. He says that he chose to leave the house because he no longer had any privacy after the trial and he got a lot of attention. However, he also wasn't paying his property taxes and basically lost the house. The house has since been demolished. The tabloids were offering people a ton of money for footage of OJ, and he and Mark started, like, staging little films that looked candid, like they looked like Mike was just happening upon OJ with the camera, but they were actually really completely planned and scripted. By the way,
Mike has also revealed something on the documentary OJ Made in America. He says that Nicole actually did have an affair with Marcus Allen. According to Mike, about a month before Nicole died, she and OJ tried to reconcile their relationship, but it didn't work out. And OJ allegedly told her, "You ever see Marcus again and I'll kill you." It turns out that Nicole had diary entries about Marcus that said she felt beautiful and sexy and smart when she was with him, as opposed to feeling jabs when with OJ. She also writes that she should have thought about Catherine, who was Marcus's wife. In the book, If I Did It, OJ does say that Marcus admitted to the affair. But Marcus still denies it. After Nicole's death, some people had observed OJ screaming at her grave, and they were under the impression that it was because of this. So, speaking of the book, If I Did It, OJ lost his book deal, but then the Goldmans were like, "This is a good opportunity for us to make the money back." And they read the book and they were like, "This is a fucking confession." So the court awarded them the rights to the book. And they renamed the book, If I Did It, Confessions of a Killer. And what they did on the cover of the book is they made the word if really small and they like fit it inside of the word I. So like if you're not looking really closely, it looks like it just says, I did it, Confessions of a Killer. And by the way, I want to clarify something. OJ didn't actually write that book. A ghostwriter wrote the book and then paid OJ to put his name on it. OJ was pretty much like, "Well, I really need the money and everybody hates me anyway," so he agreed. And this was before the court was like, "Well, you can't have that money." But they paid him something like $650,000 in advance, and he took it. OJ would end up being awarded custody of the kids, Justin and Sydney. Nicole's parents, Lou and Juditha Brown, were not okay with this. They tried to get custody of the kids, and they filed an appeal in 1998, which turned into a 5-year custody battle. In the end, OJ ended up retaining full custody, and he took the kids and moved to Florida. The kids said that they wanted to live with his dad, so the Browns were, like, kind of heartbroken and, like, kind of nervous about it, because, of course, they think the man is a killer, but they were like, "This is what the kids want, and this is what the court it has decided," so they were like, "We're just going to try to keep him at arm's length as much as we can." In 2007, OJ caught wind that all of his memorabilia and all his shit was being sold all over the place, and he started hanging out with some shady people in Florida. And when I say shady people, like, these people were admittedly shady. Like, they even said that they were like, "If OJ's hanging out with us, we know he's going downhill." OJ was planning a trip to Las Vegas for a wedding, and he told his shady friends, "Let's rob these memorabilia dealers so that I can get my stuff back." Because it also happens that they're going to be in Las Vegas. Also, the day that they're going to go do this happens to be the exact day that If I Did It was released. I can't make this shit up. So, OJ told his friend, Tom Riccio, "Look, Tom, this is not memorabilia. These are my personal artifacts that were stolen from me. My football that I was holding in my arm when I rushed for 2,000 yards. The ring from my wife who died that I thought I was going to give to my daughter. Everyone thinks nothing bad happens to me. Here I am being robbed. Why don't we just show the world that I have to go by myself to get my stuff back?" Riccio met OJ back at his hotel at the Palms, and they called up another friend, Charlie Ehrlich. OJ asked Charlie to go to the room of the memorabilia dealers and pose as a buyer so that they could see if they really had OJ's stuff. And then OJ called up another friend named Walter Alexander and asked him to join them, and he brought another friend named Michael McClinton. Alexander has been quoted as saying, "He wanted to get his stuff back. He was like, 'Hey man, will you watch my back?' So I said, 'Yeah.' And then after I said yes, he leaned in a little closer and he said, 'By the way, can you get some heat?' Meaning a gun." Alexander said that he hesitated, but then McClinton spoke up and said that he had plenty of heat. McClinton ran a small security company and he had a concealed weapons permit. So he gave Alexander one of his guns. OJ asked McClinton, "Would you go with me and be my security?" McClinton said, "Sure, I'll go with you." Alexander said, "So OJ, you know, what if they call the police?" And OJ said, "Fuck the police. What are they gonna do? Take me to jail for taking my own stuff?" Now, Charlie apparently didn't know that OJ and these other guys were also planning on coming to the room. He thought he was going alone and just going to pose as a buyer and, like, look around. But as he's, like, at the door getting ready to go in, he sees OJ walk up with a big group of guys who all look like they're out of Miami Vice. And Charlie's like, he says that he looked at them, he was like, "Man, this is such a fucking OJ thing to do." And none of these guys knew each other, but they were all, like, loyal to OJ.
Once they got to the room and they're about to go inside, OJ instructed McClinton to reveal his gun to the dealers and look menacing. They barged in and the buyers were shocked to see OJ Simpson with a face full of rage. Riccio, the sneaky fuck, turns out that he decided to audio record this whole thing. So we have all of this on record. They get in the room and OJ tells the guys to pack up all the stuff and let's get the fuck out of here. So the guys start gathering all kinds of stuff, even stuff that's not OJ's, and they start packing it all up. So even OJ's like taking this random like Joe Montana memorabilia and stuffing it into a pillowcase. So he's clearly not just trying to get his own shit back. He's like actively robbing these guys, probably because he has no money. OJ was heard saying, "Nobody leaves until I get my stuff." The fact that he says that means that not only is he facing robbery charges, but this is also considered kidnapping. Alexander pulled out his gun for a split second, and then he realized, fuck, this is armed robbery. I'm going to jail, and I'm going to be on the news. So the guys all leave, and the memorabilia dealer goes to the front desk, and he's like, "I just got robbed by OJ Simpson." They literally laughed at him. He calls 911 and the operator is like completely annoyed. So OJ took home all the stolen shit and then he went to the wedding and then he got arrested. OJ was convicted on 12 counts, including armed robbery with a deadly weapon, assault, and kidnapping. The judge, her name was Jackie Glass, gave him the maximum sentence she possibly could, which was 33 years at the Lovelock Correctional Center in Nevada. He would only serve 9 of those years. A parole panel granted him parole by unanimous vote in July 2017, and he was released that October. He was still required to abide by conditions of his parole, like he couldn't drink excessively or leave Nevada without written permission. His parole ended early, in February 2022, so for the last year, O.J. Simpson has been living as a free man here in Las Vegas. He lives in the Summerlin area. The Goldman family has been standing by, waiting, knowing that upon release, he'll try to make a living again. Kim Goldman said, "I'm not letting up. If I did, then I'm telling him it's okay for what he did." OJ got COVID in 2021, and Fred Goldman said that it was a shame that so many people lost their lives to COVID, and OJ Simpson wasn't one of them. Nicole and Fred Goldman have started a podcast called Media Circus, where they talk about private tragedies in the public eye and how the media gets it right, gets it wrong, and gets in the way. Fred Goldman insists that OJ still owes them $96 million despite what they've already gotten from them because of interest. And that's where we're going to leave off for part two. So in part three, we're going to look into all the possible theories and take a deeper look at the evidence. I want to really look at the reasons OJ could be the killer and reasons it might not be OJ. And if not OJ, who else could it possibly be? I also want to take a look into what OJ and his attorneys have all had to say since the criminal trial. So I want to reiterate that I'm really back and forth on this case. I like to challenge my opinions a little bit, so I have decided to bring somebody on the podcast who does not think that OJ did it. And this is somebody who I find really wise and I really respect. I want to go ahead and ask all of my listeners, if you have any questions or any theories, if you have any strong theories about why you think maybe OJ was not the killer, do me a favor and send them in because I want to address these things before part three. Don't forget you can go to brokenlimelight.com to see a transcript of this episode along with some of my sources. I've also included some of the clips that I mentioned, and there's a lot of interesting photos too. You can also contact me on that website or you can send me an email at ddwest@brokenlimelight.com. If you're not subscribed to my YouTube channel yet, that would really help me out. I'm under DD West. And DD West is also my social media handle on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. You can find our Facebook page under Broken Limelight. Thanks, fam. Talk to you next time. Hey guys, it's Dee Dee West, and this is my new single, Just Like Heaven. It's available now on Apple Music, YouTube Music, and Spotify. Enjoy! Well, show me how you do that trick. The one that makes me scream, he said. The one that makes me laugh, he said.
his head and dreamed of all the different ways I had to let him know. Why are you so far away? He said, why won't you ever know that I'm in love with you? Yeah, I'm in love with you. You, soft and lonely. You, lost and lonely. You, strange as angels, dancing in the deepest ocean, twisting in.
Hey, future Unnaturalists, I'm Emily.
And I'm Andy.
And we are the hosts of Unnatural, a true crime podcast.
Each week, we'll dive into some of the most unnerving crimes that this unnatural world has to offer.
Listen for Unnatural on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, make good choices.
And don't get got.
Bye.
Bark Box! You guys know my dogs, Jude and Eleanor Rigby. Well, we just started getting them Bark Box, and I'm telling you, your dogs will love you. No more are they angry at the mailman. No more, I say. It's like a box of dog joy that's delivered every month, and each box tells a different story with different themed toys, treats, and photo-worthy props. Typically, what we get in each box is a couple of toys, a couple of treats, and a chew, but you can actually tailor-fit your box to fit your dog's needs. Guys, I'm telling you, your dogs will love you, even more than they already do. So try it out, and if you use my link, you'll get a free extra month of BarkBox, which is a $35 value. So just head to BarkBox.com/BrokenLimelight and get started on your first BarkBox today.
BarkBox!
Nailed it, Jude.